Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast adventure to find the entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest Mouse says...
There's also an experience of maybe realizing that you're fixating on the line on Bugs Bunny's chest that delineates his chest muscles. And you kind of realize, oh wait, no, this is weird.
The topic is heavy metal and furries. We all have alter egos, most of us more than one. There's the person you are at work, the person you are online, the fun person you are at the beach, the responsible person you are with your parents, and the unique kind of angry person that only exists when you're waiting for everyone ahead of you to get off the airplane. But for some, those alter egos aren't people at all. My guest this week is Mouse, a furry artist who never felt like he fit in with other humans. Fortunately, times being what they are, you no longer have to fit in with humans. There's a whole big wide world of cartoon animals out there you can join instead. And as Mouse found, sometimes those people who are animals are better people than the people who are people. By the way, when this episode comes out, I'll be in Miami for the National Gay and Lesbian Journalists Association conference. If you're there, or if you just happen to be in Miami, drop me a line and say hello. I'm at Matt Baum on Twitter. And my partner James and I just gave a presentation at PAX, the game convention in Seattle, where we shared interviews that we conducted with LGBT gamers. Thanks to everyone who came out for that, and if you missed it, don't worry, we're working on bringing it to more people. If you enjoy hearing my guests open up on the sewers of Paris, I think you'll really enjoy the stories that LGBTs share in this project. We'll have more to announce soon, and you can go to playingwithpride.com to sign up for our mailing list if you'd like to be the first to know how you can see it. That's playingwithpride.com. Also, if you're heading to GamerX in San Jose in early October, we'll be there. Look for our panel, Playing with Pride. It's on October 1st at 2 p.m. and features an amazing lineup of queer people sharing their experiences as gamers. Also, a quick thanks to the folks who keep the Sewers of Paris independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you're enjoying the show, you can support it for as little as a dollar an episode. Just go to sewersofparis.com and click the Patreon button. It only takes a minute to sign up, and it really helps me keep the show going. Huge thanks to all the dozens of listeners who chip in. I could not do it without you. And now, here's Mouse. Hello, and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm joined today by Mouse. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Matt.
So, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Well, the short answer is Omaha the Cat Dancer. Have you heard of Omaha the Cat Dancer?
I've heard only briefly, so describe to me what this is.
So it's a comic book series by Reed Waller, Cat Worley, and James Vance from the late 70s till today. And it is about a cat who is a dancer.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
It's a furry comic.
Okay, and so for folks who aren't familiar with furry, how do you introduce that?
Furries are basically people who watch too many cartoons, but you could describe us as people who are maybe overly fixated on cartoon animals or anthropomorphic animals. Anthropomorphism being assigning human traits to non-human creatures.
So animals who talk and walk around and wear clothes and have jobs and that sort of thing.
Exactly. You've seen the Zootopia trailer.
As a matter of fact, yes, that's going to educate a whole generation.
Animals in Zootopia are anthropomorphic. That is just a big fancy word that means they walk around on 2 feet. They do not go to work nude. Thank you. Almost. That's got it.
The furry potential, the doors are wide open, thanks to Disney.
They
As has always been the case.
Say they have been for quite some time. Yes. But yeah, Omaha is a story about a young woman in the big city. And yeah, she's an erotic dancer, and she wants to be a star, and she wants to find herself, and she wants to find a lover, and it's a story about, yeah, her friends and her family and her lovers, and it's really groundbreaking in the way that it is a comic that really explicitly shows sexual content, but you really can't just classify it or put it in the corner of pornography, because it's really at its heart, it's a soap opera. It's a really kind of kooky story. And it's got lots of different crazy characters, and is really invested in that. And when I read it, I really fell in love with these people.
Where did you find it?
I didn't find this till I was an adult. I was interning for a comic book company called Fantagraphics, which is in Seattle. It's sort of an alternative comics press. And they have a really fantastic library where if you're an intern, you get to just kind of on the honor system, check out all of the fantastic comics that they have. And I knew about it and I had heard about it, and reading it was really kind of all of the whole series in one go up to that point. They've since, finished it. Was really incredible and really opened me up to the idea that as a comic book artist who draws erotica but also really draws stories about people, that I can do whatever I want.
Had you been holding yourself back from doing what you wanted?
I mean, that's kind of the story of my life, really.
It's the story of everybody's life.
Exactly. But it is... It is really wonderful and really inspirational and really bold and daring. And it was the inspiration for an organization called the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, which is an organization that still exists today that still defends comic book artists when their First Amendment rights are challenged by the state. Because this was a very controversial concept at the time, because this was a story that broke a lot of boundaries. It was a furry comic. It's a comic that involved anthropomorphic animals. It's a pornographic comic, but not really a pornographic comic. It's an alternative comic, but not really an alternative comic. It's a soap opera, but it's not really a soap opera. And its position in between all of these spaces made a lot of people very uncomfortable. And it was the subject of obscenity trials because, of course, as we know, comics are indeed for kids. So its position as being sold in comic book shops was considered very offensive. And actually, some people tried to deem it legally obscene. And what the judge found was actually this was a very positive portrayal of sexuality and a positive portrayal of how people interact with one another. And not only is it not obscene, this is actually this could be kind of a role model for how we talk about sex in media. And I definitely agree. It's kind of an extraordinary work of art.
So it sounds like it was really eye-opening for a lot of people, but particularly for you.
For me, as an adult, who when you're making comic books, you are definitely pushed into corners, and you're identified by genre first in a certain way. And Omaha is a work that doesn't really identify itself according to any standard, but also because, like, I'm a furry, like, it's important to comic book history, it's important to history of the furry fandom. And now that furries have kind of become more of a concrete entity in the world, comic book fandom has, I would almost say, not so much erased, but diminished or maybe minimized Omaha's importance to comics in general. And it's really important.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it was it sounds like a test case for freedom of expression in comics.
Absolutely. Absolutely it was.
And you said that it was a comic that you could look at as not being backed into a corner. Did you feel as though you were sort of backed into a corner when you found it?
No, when I found it, no. By the time I read Omaha, I was ready for it, and I was ready to be inspired by it.
Well, tell me a little about your background as a comic artist and as a furry as well.
Well, I've always been a furry. Like, almost like being gay. Like there hasn't been any sort of real psychological research on this that takes this subject seriously, but I think there's a part of being a furry that's sort of an immutable characteristic. So everyone has seen Disney's Robin Hood, and everyone acknowledges that, yes, Disney's Robin Hood is a cartoon fox. And also, yes, that Disney's Robin Hood is certifiably a total fox, right?
Yeah, there's no denying that that character has this incredible charisma that transcends species.
You know something, Robin? You're taking too many chances.
Chances? You must be joking. That was just a bit of a lark, Little John.
Yeah? Take a look at your hat. That's not a candle on a cake.
Hello. This one almost had my name on it, didn't it? They're getting better, you know. You've got to admit it. They are getting better.
Yeah. The next time, that sheriff will probably have a rope around our necks. Pretty hard to laugh hanging there, Rob.
Huh. The sheriff and his whole posse couldn't lift you off the ground. Oh, God.
Hey, watch it, Rob. That's the only hat I've got.
Oh, come along. You worry too much, old boy.
Yeah. And so that's universally kind of like that's a pretty human experience, but there's also an experience of maybe realizing that you're fixating on the line on Bugs Bunny's chest that delineates his chest muscles. And you kind of realize, oh, wait, no, this is weird. This is weird. This is weird, and I am weird.
I think a lot of people are not even cognizant of that line. Like, describe what that is, because I don't think most people even are aware of it. But it's such an important line.
Oh, God, it really is. Yeah, it's a really incidental artistic decision. When you see Bugs Bunny, he's a very simple character. And like I'm a cartoonist, and so it's like I really think of characters in terms of line, in terms of economy of line, of like you can draw as few lines as you can in order to really explain the essence of a character. Because it's a lot of work to make cartoons and to make comics. You want to simplify it. You want to streamline it. And when whoever designed Bugs Bunny, they decided it, like, what's really important, what's essential to this character is that we'd, like, draw this line in the middle of his chest section.
Yeah, and if you look at any picture, like, actual picture of Bugs, it's there. You don't notice it until someone points it out, and then you're like, oh, yeah.
I don't, especially the Chuck Jones directed shorts. It's like, I don't know. It's like, I feel so sordid talking about it because it's like, you really get this kind of perverted feeling, even as like a little kid looking at this. But I guess that's the furry sensibility, is like tapping into something that only you can kind of notice, which is also kind of the gay experience, and or maybe kind of a camp experience, you know. It's like it's there in plain view, but only if you're in the know you can really get it.
So as a kid, were there these like little signs that, like, I'm sure at the time were meaningless, but now looking back you're like, oh, okay, there was something in me that was trying to be, I was trying to express.
Oh, God, absolutely. I've been watching Don Bluth movies since I was 3 years old. And particularly, the Mouse movies. So that's The Secret of Nim, based on the amazing book, Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim.
In the beginning, we were ordinary street rats. Stealing our daily bread and living off the efforts of man's work. We were captured, put in cages, and sent to a place called Nim. There were many animals there, in cages. They were put through the most unspeakable tortures to satisfy some scientific curiosity. Often at night, I would hear them crying out in anguish. 20 rats and 11 mice were given injections. Our world began changing.
And this is definitely a case of, like, please, please read the book. It's so much better than the movie. But the movie has Don Bluth's Rats of Nim has made such an impression on me that I really love it. And it's one of the most beautiful pieces of animation ever made. And, of course, also American Tail.
Honest John!
It's Gussie Mousheimer.
We, the richest and most powerful mouse in New York. What's she doing slumming in this part of town?
There's a dead mouse on that table.
It's an Irish custom, Gussie. The cats got him today.
Precisely why I am here to see you.
Would you care for a wee drop of the creature?
Today was the worst ever. Those cats are killing everyone. They don't even know the difference between rich and poor. The wretches.
Oh, shameful.
There's a real dichotomy of children's movies between Disney and Bluth. Of course, there's a lot more out there, but I think you can really draw a line because Disney doesn't really do anything for me, and Don Bluth movies are, pardon my French, but they're all really fucked up.
I'd say that's completely accurate. I mean, even like the great, like Rats of Nim, is beyond just dark. It's like a, oh my God, what's going on kind of movie. I mean, as is the book.
It's perverted. And Don Bluth finds a way to draw all of his specific fetishes into all of his kids' movies, and it's all there in Rats of Nim. There is a kind of like Hibari bondage. There is,
sorry,
drowning.
At what point is there bondage?
When the shrew ties up Jeremy. There is drowning. There is submersion in water. There is being submersed into a goo or an ooze or a mud. There is Dom DeLuise.
Some of these things are not immediately, the sexuality of them is not immediately apparent.
No, but what is absolutely immediately apparent is Justin.
And describe that character.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, to describe Justin, I have to describe Mrs. Frisbee, who I love, who is probably my first gay, like, diva, my first strong female character, who I really bonded with. She's a mouse who is just an ordinary field mouse, but she married a mouse who was a product of medical experiments that enhanced his intelligence. And he became part of a tribe of rats who were under the same experiments, who are stronger, who are more intelligent, who are more clever, who can read human writing. And she can't. And she's a widower. Her husband has died. And there's a circumstance, like the circumstance of the movie is that, like, she's in danger. The farmer is going to plow her field where her home is. She's totally inadequate. She's totally afraid, but she has to save her family.
The plow has come early this year.
Move your family.
Yes, I would move, but Timothy has pneumonia. He can't even get out of bed.
You must move to a place where it'll be safe from the plow.
Please, there must be another way.
There is no other way. I must bid you good evening,
Mrs. Frisbee.
Frisbee? Mrs. Jonathan Frisbee?
Why, yes. He was my husband. But how do you know about him?
That is not important. I will say this. His name is not unknown in these woods.
Please, sir. I'll do anything to save Timmy. Anything.
So she has to ask for help, and she goes to the rats. And the rats are a colony of, yeah, like a colony of genetically engineered rats who are super intelligent. And she is just so brave and so strong and yet so humble that she has to ask for help. And it's such a wonderful human moment in this movie when she asks for help from the rats, and the rats say, of course, we'll help you. Because your husband was Jonathan. He was one of us. And Justin is one of the rats who is, like, weirdly kind of a romantic lead in the movie, even though they don't really get together. But he is a rat who is just kind of devastatingly handsome. And that's kind of a weird thing for a three-year-old proto gay creature to process.
Justin, you featherhead. Get your hands off me.
Okay, just a joke. I didn't mean any harm. The meeting's already in progress.
What's this all about?
Who may I ask?
Oh, yes, she can be trusted. This is no stranger. My dear, may I present Justin, the captain of the guard. Justin, Mrs. Brisby.
Not Mrs. Jonathan Brisby.
Yes, the same.
It is an honor and a privilege, my lady.
If we could dispense with the formalities.
How beautiful.
Ma'am?
The lights. They're quite lovely.
Yes, they are. We've had electricity for 4 years now.
Five.
Jonathan often spoke of electricity.
But you see, our shame is that we're stealing it from Farmer Fitzgibbons.
I've always used the term debonair to describe him.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, he knows what he's doing. He is really... He sweeps Mrs. Frisbee. I guess I should call her Mrs. Brisby because of copyright.
Frisbee in the book, movie. Brisby in the movie.
Exactly. Thank you. But yeah, he sweeps her off her feet. He sweeps me off my feet instantly. Like he's irresistible.
And there's also just the loveliness of what a community the rats have.
It's treated on very lightly in the movie because it's a movie for three-year-olds. The most beautiful movie for three-year-olds ever made, but Mrs. Frisbee finds herself in the middle of a political debate, a divide between the rats, because they have been siphoning electrical power off of the farmer whose land they've been living on. And they're at a point of crisis where they have to move. Mrs. Frisbee has to move, and the rats have to move because the farmer is going to physically extricate them from their land. And there are rats who say, we should keep siphoning energy from the farmer. And there are rats who are saying, we are intelligent beings, and stealing is wrong. We should make our own way in life. And we should, and like, it's part of our dignity as intelligent creatures to not steal and to not sneak around. Yeah, it's kind of a meditation on capitalism that is totally inappropriate for young viewers, I think, or maybe over, like, totally over people's heads. Like, so the only thing that wasn't over my head when I was a small being was that, like, I wanted to be Mrs. Frisbee and that I wanted to date Justin.
Well, yeah, so in what way? Like, what did you identify with? How were you like her?
She is small. She's helpless. She doesn't want to do anything in the world but to protect her family. Or really to be comfortable and just keep on living in this comfortable way. And when that is disrupted, she has to discover a part of herself that is courageous. A part of herself that confronts her own fear or her own sense of protecting herself. Because when you protect your family, you have to be bigger than yourself.
Did you feel that need? Like, did you feel a need to protect your family?
No. Or I had the need to, I don't know. I was very lucky and that my family protected me.
Well, tell me a little about that. Like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in South Central Alabama. I was born in Opelika. My mom was a single mother. I knew my biological father very briefly. And it was a fine relationship while it was material, and it was not. She's never revealed to me why they split up, and I'm actually totally fine with that. I'm totally fine with him being a stranger, because he's been fine being a stranger to me. But my mom worked very hard to do the thing that most parents do, which is to make a better life for your child than yourself. She was able to rise out of a position of struggle to make sure that I could be in the position of being a spoiled hipster wastrel by the time I got to college age.
Were you, like, in what way were you a hipster wastrel?
Well,
like, what were your interests then?
Drawing comic books. Not being a productive member of society. Just still absorbing myself in cartoons and comics and art and design and music and things that are of no real practical use to most people.
But surely these things were feeding your soul in some way.
Oh, absolutely.
What were the things that you were preoccupied by?
Yeah, here's where we get into the long answer of the media that changed my life. It's cartoons and comics. It's media featuring anthropomorphic animals, talking animals. They've been with me my whole life, and they've absolutely fascinated me. Like I said, I bring up being a furry is sort of an immutable condition. Like, you know how some teenage girls are stereotyped as being like having a period, a phase when they are like obsessed with horses.
Yes.
For a lot of furries, that period, and this is not gender specific, of course. For a lot of furries, that period is replaced by being obsessed with foxes. Maybe not anymore. I don't know. This might be a 90s thing.
It's generational. Well, what were the foxes?
Furries are absolutely generational. They are as ruthlessly generational as mainstream gay culture.
Really? So what was it for you? I mean, I know Robin Hood, obviously. Robin Hood kind of transcends the decades, but who else?
Anything. Robin Hood. Oh, my God. Fox and the Hound.
Which Don Bluth worked on.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
I think he's uncredited. But yeah, he was on that one. It was right before he left.
What you smelling? I'm on the trail, son.
Trail what?
I don't know yet.
Why, it's you.
What do you do that for? We're supposed to do that. When we find what we've been tracking.
I'm a fox. My name's Todd. What's your name, kid?
Mine's Copper.
I'm a hound dog.
Gee, I bet you'd be good playing hide and seek. You want to try it, Copper?
I had like a little plush like stuffed animal, like a little fox, that I got when I was a kid. And I kind of just kept it around and like, even when I was getting into high school and I was getting into like hardcore punk rock and I was into like death metal even, I would play in shows and I would have this little like fox plush animal and I would perch it on like my bass amp. I still am. Like I was really into heavy metal and heavy metal culture, and heavy metal is so much about having a posture, having a thing that says, like, this is who I am. And even then, I had a posture against the posture where I had to say, like, this is really who I am. So I'm playing this brutal, nasty, disgusting music. And then there's like this cute little cute little guy who's like my avatar, like, and he's like on my amp. Like, mm-hmm. he's on the device that amplifies my art to the world.
So if it wasn't the posture and the swagger and the, I guess, the scariness of the metal, or was it? Was that something that appealed to you? Or did you have to kind of push back against it?
There was a bit of pushing out against it because I wasn't out yet, except to my friends. Like, I was out to my friends who I was in bands with. Heavy metal is kind of anonymizing. Like, everyone wears the same black clothes, and everyone has the same, like, inscrutable, unreadable logo for their death or black metal band. And everyone has the same kind of veneer of nihilism or whatever. So, yeah, like, that was a way of standing out. That was a way of making myself sort of vulnerable in a community where I felt extremely vulnerable in, because homophobia is absolutely still rampant in punk rock and in heavy metal culture.
Did you have any favorite bands or favorite songs?
Yeah, I had a couple. I was, like, my musical identity was definitely divided between any kind of heavy metal, from Iron Maiden to Decapitated, Emperor, and, yeah, like, any sort of unholy black metal, and...
Just what I saw in my old dreams were the reflections of my woman staring back at me. Cause in my dreams, it's always there. The evil face that twists my mind and brings me to despair.
I think the most enduring part of my musical experience has been power metal, which is, like, very much inspired by, like, Queen, and is, it's not the queerest kind of metal because there's not a lot of queer expression in metal, but it's maybe the most feminine metal. Like,
oh, that's interesting. Like, so give me an example of, like, a band that is of the genre that you like there.
I can say definitely in college, which I very much looked forward to as my, like, coming out experience. And I did come out, but I never really slept around. I didn't have any kind of Rumspringa in college. I was still very kind of conservative with myself. So, like, instead of sleeping with guys, I would just make them listen to Dragon Force.
And what were you having them listen to? Like, what did you want them to hear in that?
I'm discovering, just in reading and researching about maybe sort of mental health fields, there's a concept called stimming among people who have autism. And this is a behavior when you are feeling overwhelmed by sensory exposure. And in order to kind of get back to a baseline, kind of a normal state of being, you exert a behavior that maybe seems very strange to other people. Like, I've always, when I felt anxious or when I felt overwhelmed, I've always kind of, like, scratched my head. Like, it's just, like, what I do to get back to zero. And I've never thought about that. And other people are kind of like, are you okay, dude? And so, like, listening to certain types of heavy metal invokes that exact same sort of soothing response. Like specifically, like just like musical things, like a drum pattern, which is called blast beats. And I can link you to an example of what that is, but it's like it's all drums all the time. Or when a guitar player plays an arpeggio in a particularly rhythmic way that flows up and down along the scale in such a way, I find that so at the same time very stimulating and very exciting, but also very soothing and comforting.
How did people respond when you put this music in front of them?
Nobody likes it.
Oh. Did you have like incidents of people being like, "I don't get it"?
Oh, every time. It was, but like, I mean, it's fine. I mean, everyone likes what they like in music.
Now, you'd mentioned that you're mostly closeted until you got to college, and we're looking forward to that as a coming out time. Were you closeted gay and closeted furry, or was that something that you were coming out as both at the same time, or how did you discover that?
That's a funny thing to talk about, because I'm mostly closeted gay and furry, because it's still kind of a weird misunderstood thing, but there's a really incredible comic that I can relate to in my experience of like going to college and then coming out. It's called Associated Student Bodies. It's a furry comic again. It's written by Lance Rund and it's drawn by Chris McKinley. It's very much a piece of really profound, powerful wish fulfillment about a closeted gay kid who goes to college, and he gets into his dorm, and he learns that of course he's gay, and he learns that everyone in his dorm is gay. He's in the gay dorm. He's magically found, like Shangri-La. Listen, this comic is mostly pornographic. So, like, as a high school student learning about the existence of this comic, it was kind of an aspirational experience of just being able to find it and read it, because it's kind of commodified, like the print copies. Like, you can find it online, but I couldn't at that time, or I didn't feel comfortable like searching it because I was afraid of looking for furry porn online. And like that experience of like looking forward to college or looking forward to any sort of escape from my home environment where I could really be myself was really powerful and really important. And I really cherish the experience, not so much of reading the comic, although, I mean, like, I'm very proud to own the hardbound, like, special edition, but really the experience of wanting to read the comic was like the experience of wanting to go to college and want to go into this magical world where everybody's gay. And that kind of happened to me when I went to college.
Did it? Did you find a gay community there?
Yes, I did.
Where'd
yes,
you go?
I think I might be like the third or fourth guest of yours who went to the Savannah College of Art and Design.
Oh, yeah. Something about that place.
Yeah. Something about that place. But yeah, like, I went for another field, but I ended up studying sequential art, which is a fancy way of saying comic books, which, I mean... probably shouldn't have done that, whatever, but like, yeah, I ended up in a peer group and a friend group and a, I guess, potential dating pool. I didn't really, but just a group of people who are mostly gay men and lesbians. And yeah, like I went from a period of my life where my environment was 99% straight. And then I went to an environment which was maybe 85% gay.
So did you have sort of an explosion out of the closet where you just had a ton of stuff to explore?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
No. I was still the same inward-looking, shy, self-conscious, anxious, mousy person that I was before. But I was finally in a place where I had permission to just be myself.
So you could be mousy and not feel guilty about it?
Yeah. I was teased a lot for just being this little shrinking thing. And I had found friends who maybe had been that themselves as kids and maybe had more success blossoming than I did, but understood that. I had my first kiss. I had my first experience of being out. I was definitely in college, like openly gay and openly furry to people because I was with artists.
So now you had grown up in an environment that was fairly conservative, and yeah, it's hard to avoid knowing that gay is a thing that exists. But how did you find out that furry was a thing that you weren't the only one who was into the fox and who was into the line in Bugs Bunny's chest?
Well, how I found out about that was when I was a very young teen, and an issue of Vanity Fair came out. I don't know which one, but it was Julianne Moore was on the cover. And she was wearing a gorgeous green dress of some sort. But I remember just like peeping through that, and there was an article. Yeah, like it was basically look at these freaks. And as a kid, I didn't really have the tools to understand intellectually that he's ridiculing us, he's making fun of us, he's objectifying us and setting us apart as this other thing. I just immediately saw it. I was maybe 12, and I said, "Sign me up."
What was it about that you wanted?
Community, a sense of... No, not a sense of. The experience of, the real life of people who want to be a cartoon animal so badly that they fucking do it. They put on a costume and they go out in a public space and they commune together and they make art together, and a lot of it's transgressive and weird and strange and fetishistic, and they're only accountable really to the people who are there, to the community. It was like a lightning bolt. I said, "This is me. How do I get into this?" And the answer was the internet. Like the furry community started in like the late 1970s, early 1980s at sci-fi conventions of people just like discussing speculative fiction about like maybe human animal hybrids. And they started having meetings and then room parties and then gatherings of their own. There's a historian named Fred Patton who does a great history of the early furry community. What really made it explode and blow up was the internet. People being able to chat with each other and talk with each other. And as a 14-year-old, there are certainly interactions with furries who I certainly understand now, like, ought not have happened.
Oh, well, what was your first contact with the furry community like?
I was role-playing. I was pretending to be a cartoon animal, much like you pretend to be an elf in Dungeons & Dragons, on AOL Instant Messenger in the 90s. Oh my god, to be in a gay space on AOL Instant Messenger in the 90s, oh, past mouse, I'm sorry, but... And I was browsing artwork. I was furiously consuming furry art on websites like the Vixen Controlled Library, or it's abbreviated as VCL, or even auction sites, like places where people sell furry paraphernalia and memorabilia and art and costumes and drawings called, like, I think it was like Furby. There's tons more, but like, it was one of those auction sites where I realized I was gay.
How did you realize?
So I was just in that weird window of being a young teen, on the internet in the 90s. This was a site where it's, you know, it's like people were putting stuff on sale. There was an adult section. You gotta click a box and says, like, I'm an adult, I can look at this. And of course I did. And so I was looking at stuff that people were selling, and I would tell myself, I can look at this stuff, it's fine. I'm just looking, whatever. But I won't look at stuff with guys in it. And that came to a point where I said, well, I won't look at stuff with guys by themselves in it. And that came to a point where I said, I wouldn't look at stuff with guys with other guys in it. And when I'm saying guys, I'm like talking about like a badger and a wombat or what, you know?
Sure, sure.
And then one day, like, yeah, like I caught myself, and then I said, well, it will look, okay, like, I won't look at art with like guys or other guys or just guys, and I won't linger. And one day I found myself looking at a pink husky or wolf type creature and in a sexually compromised position. And I caught myself lingering. And I had this moment, like 13, 14, like, oh shit. This is, no, I can't walk away from this. This is my life now. Like, I like guys.
Sure.
And pink huskies, apparently.
Yeah, there's that double realization of not only am I into pink huskies, but I'm also into male pink huskies. Or not only am I into men, but I'm into men who are also dogs.
Yeah, cartoon dogs.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's important to clarify, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about...
Oh, there's tons. What's that? Like, I have been a furry, like, active in the community, online, going to conventions, dressing in costume. Yes, dressing in costume. Since I was a kid, and I write about furry culture for a website called The Hoodie Utilitarian. And a lot of what I write about is just kind of in response to, let's say, I don't really want to be a writer, but there isn't a furry glad, you know? Furries have always had a very difficult relationship with the media. At first, it started as, look at these freaks. Now we've moved to a little bit more of a sympathetic situation, but it's very condescending. And we're still in a place where journalists can lean on the crutch that, like, no one's really going to complain and no one's going to stick up for us. So they can be lazy and they can pull stuff out of their ass when describing our community and describing our culture. Like, just recently, I just saw something, and furry was tangential to the topic of the article at hand, but they had expressed some idea that, like, a yiff party is a room where furries gather to have sex. And that, that is totally something that, like, an outsider, like, just pulled out of their ass, drawing inferences from other non-furries writing about furries. And that sort of thing upsets me. It pisses me off because people feel safe making shit up about us.
So you had these early interactions online with folks, you know, role-playing as a persona. What was your first in-person interaction with the furry community?
Furry Week in Atlanta, 2012.
How old were you?
I think I was 21. Yeah. I've been interacting online, since I was
too young to be doing that.
No, really, please. Teenage furries, take care of yourself and be wary of people who don't have your best interest at heart. But no, I was in college. And I was going to school in Savannah, and my family was in Atlanta. So, like, I thought I'll go to Atlanta, and I'll go to this convention. I didn't know anybody there. I didn't have any expectations. This was almost like, it's odd because, like, I'd been a real capital F furry for so long, but, like, this going to a real life meetup was kind of tourism to me.
How so? Like, did you feel like you didn't belong there?
I felt like I would be safe if I went there and if I thought it was not cool or I felt uncomfortable. I could just be like, eh, I'll just stay online.
And was it not cool?
Oh, it was totally cool. It was amazing.
What was amazing about it?
Well, first of all, I was not really sure about. I didn't really understand the costuming aspect of it or how we call it. We call it fursuiting, dressing up in like a mascot costume. I was like, I don't get it. This is weird. I don't understand it. And as soon as I got there, when I first saw like someone in a fursuit and my jaw dropped, I was just like, you're amazing. This is so, like, it was so cool.
What was the suit? Do you remember?
I think it was like a green cow or something. I don't remember it very vividly, but I remember the feeling I felt of just like the night and day difference between a prejudiced view, an outsider's view into actually seeing it. And that really changed like years later when I actually got to wear a fursuit. Oh my God. But also like at that convention, like I had been online and I had two people approach me and say like, are you fill in the blank, the handle that I had been using at that time. And I was like, yes. And they're like, oh, we love your art. We're big fans of your work. Do you want to get lunch? Do you want to hang out? And they were so sweet and so wonderful. And one of them is still like a friend that I really treasure at this time and a really wonderful person. It's like, that's a part of the furry experience. If you can, if you're able to, you know, afford the admission, if you have the mobility, if you have the social comfort to go to this, like, there's so many benefits.
So tell me about the benefits. Like, what did it change for you?
I think about the phrase gay community, which never really meant a whole lot to me in my real life. For a lot of reasons, because just like I'm shy, I have different values, a different way of interacting socially with people. Furry for me is my gay community. And the fact that all of my furry friends are almost all gay or bisexual or transgender.
What does that community do for you?
We love each other. We support each other. We boost each other's creative pursuits. When someone is in trouble, when someone is homeless, when someone is being abused by a romantic partner or by their parents, furries show up to support each other and to boost each other and lift each other up.
Has the community helped you in any way?
Yeah. As an artist, a person trying to express themselves, as someone trying to figure out who I am, furries have always been there. Furry is nothing but having a space that is safe. I mean, basically safe from, like, violence. To be weird and to, like I said, even the basic act of creating like a fursona. This is like your cartoon animal character who is you, who represents you. In doing that, you can represent parts of yourself that you can't tangibly represent in your real life.
So what was that for you? Like, what are you representing?
Of course, before I was out, it was sexuality. It has a lot to do with gender and how I understand that and how I'm exploring what that means to me, besides just being inhabiting the gender and the body of my birth. You can inhabit a body, you can inhabit a spirituality, you can inhabit a creature that isn't you in order to express a part of you that you really can't in polite society.
So what have you learned about yourself in the process of exploring all these different things? What are the discoveries you made?
Tons of things. I mean, mostly dealing with bodies and sexuality, and that all of these things are fluid, and not really static, and that you can be whatever you want to be. Like, Bugs Bunny can smash Daffy Duck with a hammer, and Daffy Duck can walk away and reappear as whole in the next short, you know, almost reinvented in a sort of way through furry art and through, to be frank, through furry porn. I found a way to give myself permission to love myself and give myself permission to love my partners in the way that the infrastructure of Christianity and heteronormativity and masculinity did not prepare me for in any really constructive way.
So how do you express yourself now? I know that your identity is mouse, but you also have a fursuit and you have, you know, an identity that is mutable. So what is your identity?
You tell me. Oh, my God.
Well, what are the different ways that you draw yourself or the different ways that you dress up?
Well, I'm wearing a romper and tights and high heels right now. But actually, this is a wonderful thing about being furry is you don't have to have one fursona. I'm mouse. My fursona is mouse. And my mouse fursona is mutable. My mouse fursona is male, or she is female. She can be anything. She just wears big, dorky Coke bottle glasses like I do. That's the only thing that connects the human mouse to the cartoon mouse. But I also have a coyote who is, really, it's all the guys I felt attracted to and oughtn't have, which is brash and assertive and snarky and protecting themselves with sarcasm in a way that I kind of scorn, but also really envy that ability. And that's the character Maji in my comic, which I guess I'll plug at the end of the show. And that's the fursuit that I have. My fursuit is a coyote, even though I'm a mouse. And when I wear him, I inhabit that trickster part of my personality, or the part of my personality that I wish I could sometimes inhabit in order to feel, you know, more comfortable, to feel more cool with myself.
So you've got these two sides. You've got the mouse who sounds very vulnerable and, you know, it's a creature of prey. And then you've got the coyote who's awfully, I don't know if powerful is exactly the right word, but much more in control of his circumstances.
Oh, yeah. He's all the charming, devastating, intelligent, hot guys I've ever been equally attracted to and repulsed by.
And you feel, when you have the suit on, you feel like you're one of those characters.
I can be. I can at least form a bridge to make Mouse feel more okay. And I do. Like I said, like the mouse persona is, it goes back to Miss Frisbee, who is overwhelmed by this world of the farmer is plowing his field. The farmer is going to destroy your home. There's nothing you can do about it. No, there's not nothing you can do about it. You can stand up for your family. You can ask for help. You can be a hero, even though you're petrified and you don't want to be anything other than a lover and a caretaker. You can rise up and you can be strong. And that feeling of being a little mouse in a big world, in any context, of as being dramatic as Mrs. Frisbee, or as just as something like cute, like, oh, look at me, I'm hiding in a corner and sleeping in a sardine can. Like, that's something I just really understand and really identify with. Like, that's why I'm mouse, rather than my birth name, which is the revenging archangel, which I am absolutely not.
You mean, like, literally? Is that what your birth name translates to?
Yeah, I was named Michael.
Oh.
I've always hated that name. I've always thought it was ugly. I've always felt so uncomfortable being called that. So, what better time than being an adult and having control of your own destiny and than to take at least what your own name is? What's a name?
Well, Mouse, thank you so much for joining me. Where can people find your work?
Okay. Are you ready for some intense plugging for
yes.
just 30 seconds? I'm sorry. But
please, no. Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Matt. So if you want to find my art and my partner's art, you can find us at Goat and Mouse on Tumblr. If you want to find out my horrible dad puns and absurdist humor, you can find me on Twitter at Funny Animal Book. My partner and I are participants in several podcasts. We've got an absurdist humor podcast called Brine Weekly, like Brine, like pickle brine, weekly, like weekly. And we do a Star Trek podcast called Starfleet Academy Truants. And you can just Google all of these and look in the show notes. And okay, I think I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you again so much for joining me.
I've had a lovely time. You've been very sweet. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks again to Mouse for joining me, and also for the lovely illustration that he drew depicting me as a rabbit. As a slightly nervous, always listening, mostly herbivore, no depiction could possibly be more appropriate. For more of Mouse's work, check out his latest project, Mice Making Love, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's at micemakinglove.tumblr.com, and the art spans all genders and sexualities, kinks, partner arrangements, body types, and just to warn you, there is one cat. For my recommendation this week, I'd like you to turn your gaze to another character with large ears, Pinocchio. Specifically, give the Pleasure Island scene a watch, if you dare. It is full-on dark Disney, a fantastically scary form of body horror that will stay with you whether you want it to or not. I'm sure you're familiar with the scene. Pinocchio and Lampwick and the other bad boys have found their way to an island where pleasures await, but when they indulge too much, they're turned into donkeys and sent to work in salt mines. The scene where Lampwick struggles and screams as he changes is unforgettable, no matter how you interpret it, and it culminates in Pinocchio's body starting to change as well. He drank and smoked, and as a result, our hero grows ears and a tail. In the movie, this is depicted as horrifying, and yes, if it goes any further and he's confined to bestial labor in the salt mines, it is indeed a troubling fate. But Pinocchio's changes really stop at the ideal point, subtle enough that he can hide them in a hat or down his pants, but still an unmistakable badge of his adventure. A little reminder that it's not necessarily a bad thing to have some fun, to go a little wild, to be disobedient, just as long as you can keep it under your hat. Thanks again for listening. If you're enjoying the show, I hope you'll become a supporter on Patreon. It's quick and easy, and your support keeps the show alive. Just visit sewersofparis.com and click the Patreon button to sign up, and check out the show notes at sewersofparis.com to watch video clips of everything we talked about on this week's show. Or you can support the show for free. Just tweet or Facebook about it or leave an iTunes review. I'm really, really grateful to all the folks who have helped spread the word about the Sewers of Paris. Because of your tweets, I've booked some exciting high-profile guests who saw online praise for the show and reached out to say, hey, can I be on the show too? So stay tuned for those. Remember to head over to playingwithpride.com to find out when you can see the stories we've gathered from queer gamers, and say hi if you'll be at GamerX in October or at the NLGJA meeting this weekend. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.